This week we will be studying 2 Chronicles 29 through 31 in the first of what I expect will be four messages about King Hezekiah of Judah. Hezekiah is a significant king. He reigned in Judah at the time when the northern kingdom of Israel fell to the Assyrians. Immediately after that conquest, the Assyrians turned their focus on Judah. In considering those matters, there will be significant overlap between Hezekiah's reign and the ministry of Isaiah the prophet. Thankfully, Hezekiah was a righteous king, and God delivered his kingdom, but we won't get to the Assyrian threat until next week. This week, we will focus on Hezekiah and his religious reforms. Herein, we'll learn that a good government is a God-fearing government, and that those who practice the faith should expect to be mocked by the unbelieving world, and that God has always desired a sincere heart of worship over ceremony and ritual. Your passage for consideration, then, is 2 Chronicles 29 through 31, and if you have not read it yet, I recommend that you pause and do so now. Starting in 2 Chronicles 29, we first read of Hezekiah the standard introductions. His mother was Abijah, daughter of Zechariah. He took the throne at the age of 25, and he reigned for 29 years. He took over for his wicked father Ahaz in what, by my calculations, was the 228th year after the split, 728 BC, about 6 years before the northern kingdom fell. A quick note, Hezekiah took the throne after his father Ahaz's death, when Hezekiah was 25 years old. Ahaz had begun to reign when he was 20, and he reigned for 16 years, so he died at 36. So if Hezekiah was 25 when his father Ahaz was 36, that means Hezekiah was born when his father was 11 years old. Apparently Ahaz wasted no time getting to business. Hezekiah was an apple which fell far from the proverbial tree. Unlike his father, he did right as his ancestor David had done. In fact, we're going to have three chapters here describing all of the religious reforms he made. First and foremost, he reopened the temple. If you go back 2 weeks to our message about Hezekiah's father, King Ahaz, you will recall that he was a very evil king. He kowtowed to the king of Assyria. He raided the temple treasuries to buy his favor. He worshipped foreign gods. He replaced the altar with a new foreign design. He cut apart and destroyed the holy things. And eventually he shuttered the temple altogether in favor of setting up shrines all around Jerusalem. It was a terrible thing. But Ahaz only lasted for so long, and once he was gone, Hezekiah took a hard turn of correction and brought Judah back on track. In his first month as king, he reopened the temple, repairing its doors. Once he had done this, he assembled the priests and Levites and gave them a stirring speech. He pointed out that their fathers had done wrong. They had done evil by turning away from Jehovah. They had shut up the temple and abandoned its rituals. This had come with dire consequences. There had been war on every side. Men had died. Jerusalem had fallen under the influence of the Assyrians. They were an object of horror and astonishment and hissing. But Hezekiah wanted this generation to do things differently. He intended to renew the covenant with Jehovah, and so he called on the priests and Levites to consecrate themselves, that is, to perform their cleansing ceremonies, and to cleanse and purify the temple, that they would be ready to return to Jehovah's service. In verses 12 through 14, we have a list of some of the leading priests and Levites who got to the work. These were descendants of some familiar names. These were descendants of David's musicians, Asaph and Heman and Jeduthun, and members of the clans of Kohath and Gershon and Merari, the sons of Levi. But while these men came from familiar stock and have common Levitical names, we see little of them outside this chapter. A handful of these names appear in chapter 31, also today's reading, as helping to manage temple finance and the distribution of funds. A man named Azariah appears as chief officer over the temple. One Shimei shows up in chapter 31 as second in charge of temple accounting during Hezekiah's reign, with Mahath appearing as an assistant in managing funds and Shemaiah as a worker in distributing funds. Whether these are the same individuals mentioned here in chapter 29 is not perfectly clear. Mahath is the only one of those names that is anything less than very common. And so these men got to work purifying both themselves and the holy things. They purified themselves, and then they took all of the unclean things out of the temple, dumping them in the brook Kidron. It took them 8 days to get everything cleaned out, and then, once it was cleaned out, they spent another 8 days repairing and purifying what was left. At the end of 16 days, the priests and Levites who had gotten to work reported back to Hezekiah, letting him know that everything in the temple had been made ready for service. Apparently not everyone got to work, though. 29:34 mentions that not all the priests had consecrated themselves by the time that Hezekiah offered his sacrifices, and 30:15 tells us that even by the time they offered the Passover, many of the priests still had not done so, to such a degree that the Levites had to step in and assist with priestly work, such that these unconsecrated priests were ashamed of themselves. We don't really get a clear indicator of why these priests were so slow about being consecrated. Perhaps some of them in the older generation had gotten comfortable with idol worship and were disinclined to listen to a young king turning things on their heads. Maybe they were trying to hedge their bets, acknowledging the political reality of the strength of the Assyrians, wanting to keep their religious ideals and unwilling to bet on Hezekiah keeping power for long. Maybe these consecrations just took time and they were struggling to get everything done. Whatever the reason, some of these guys stayed unconsecrated for months. Regardless, Hezekiah set about the duty of making sacrifices. He gathered together the priests and the Levites and the people and made a sacrifice on behalf of the entire assembly. He sacrificed 7 of several species, bulls, rams, lambs, and goats, and the priests put the animal's blood on the altar as the ritual required. This was an expensive ceremony. The sacrificed animals would have cost something like 20,000 inflatable paper dollars. These animals were apparently sacrificed in pursuance of Leviticus 14:13 and so forth, which required a bull as a sin offering for an unintentional sin of the entire assembly. Since the sin was so great, Hezekiah made it 7 times over, and not just with a bull, but with just about everything else that was suitable for sacrifice. The sacrifices were accompanied with music, that of harps, lyres, and cymbals, played by the Levites as had been done in the time of David. The priests also played their trumpets, as had been done even since the time of Moses. And so the musicians played and the people sang as the offering was made. Then, once the offering had been made, Hezekiah led the people to bow down in prayer and worship. Thereafter, Hezekiah led the people in more songs of praise, singing the Psalms of David and Asaph, such that the people praised God with much gladness. Having purified the people as a whole, Hezekiah then invited the people to bring their own personal sacrifices and offerings to Jehovah. The people brought offerings by the hundreds and the thousands, a total of 3,200 sheep, 670 bulls, and 100 rams. That's a lot of livestock to butcher, something worth like 1.7 million modern inflatable dollars. It was, in fact, so much that the consecrated priests could not handle it all. Imagine butchering thousands of animals all at once like that. It must have been a logistical nightmare. So the Levites who had been consecrated stepped in to assist. We note here a bending of the rules to get the job done. Apparently God was more concerned with the heart of the people than he was with strict observance of the rules. And other offerings were made as well, like peace offerings and drink offerings. And so the temple was reopened and the people greatly rejoiced. Apparently they also had not been very happy with the idolatrous reign of Hezekiah's father Ahaz. Moving on to chapter 30, having reopened the temple, Hezekiah took the next logical step by observing the holy days prescribed in the law of Moses. This meant calling all the people in for the Passover. And when we say that he called the people in, we mean that he called all of the people in, not just from the tribe of Judah, but from the tribes of the northern kingdom. Bear in mind, this was 728 BC, 4 years after Tiglath-Pileser had taken into exile the first captives from the tribes east of the Jordan. This was 6 years before Israel was totally taken captive to Assyria in 722, and 3 years before Samaria was put under siege. We might view this as the northern kingdom's final call to repentance before the disaster struck. Hezekiah ordered that a proclamation be made all the way from Dan, the city which traditionally represents Israel's farthest northern extent, to Beersheba, the city which traditionally represents Judah's farthest southern extent, inviting the people of Israel to the Passover. Hezekiah drafted letters telling all of the people of Israel to return to Jehovah. He urged them, as the children of Abraham, that if they would return to Jehovah, perhaps he would turn again to those of them who had escaped the king of Assyria. Perhaps their brothers and sons who had been taken captive would return. It is tragic that they would not listen to this, seeing that so shortly thereafter, the king of Assyria came back for the rest of them. Hezekiah urged the Israelites not to be like their fathers, not to stubbornly persist in their wrongdoing, but to submit to Jehovah and serve him in his temple. So couriers took these letters from Hezekiah and carried them all throughout the northern kingdom. The passage says that they went as far as Zebulun. By the boundaries that Joshua set, Zebulun is far in the north, but does not reach all the way to the farthest northern extent. So I'm not sure if maybe those boundaries had gotten shifted or if the couriers gave up before they made it all the way. The passage also mentions that they went to Asher's territory, which does reach to the farthest northern point. So maybe they did go everywhere. At the very least, I think it is safe to assume that they reached some representative city of every tribe. However far it was exactly that they went, they didn't have an easy time of it. Wherever they went, they were mostly mocked and laughed at to the point that this was excessively offensive and demeaning. The northern kingdom, by and large, were just lost. They had chosen the wrong path generations ago. They were entrenched in their sins. They were blinded to the light that would show them the correct spiritual path. Giving them the truth was like giving pearls to swine. Can you imagine doing their job? Often in this generation, I feel that I am. But there is some good news. Among those tribes, there were a few who humbled themselves and followed to Jerusalem. And of course, the people of Judah followed the king. As for the Passover itself, according to the law of Moses, it was to be held in the first month. See Exodus 12 for that. But owing to the complexities of the situation, the entire assembly agreed that it would be better for this one year to keep the Passover in the second month. Generally, I tend to be one to stick strictly to the rules, but we can understand the decision to bend things here. The logistics were a nightmare, I'm sure. As we've seen, there had been temple renovations to complete, priests who needed to be consecrated, and thousands of less than willing people at far-flung distances who needed to be invited. They would be preparing to pack Jerusalem with thousands of people. The unfortunate reality was just that they would not have been able to hold the festivities on time. So in this rare instance, they chose to move the feast back by 1 month. This, we note, is yet a second instance of Hezekiah setting the hearts of the people ahead of the ceremonial rules. And so when the time came, the people came, and there was a very large assembly in Jerusalem. They tore down the altars which had been erected around the city by Hezekiah's father Ahaz, throwing them as rubbish into the brook Kidron. Today, the city of Jerusalem has expanded to completely encompass the Kidron Valley, but throughout Bible times, the Kidron Valley was outside the walls of Jerusalem, just east of the city. Having thrown out the pagan shrines, the people sacrificed their Passover lambs. Seeing all of this, the priests and Levites were ashamed. Apparently, many of these had still been dragging their feet about getting consecrated, perhaps thinking that the people were not going to get in line with this new religious order. But now, seeing the great zeal of the people, they were finally moved to be consecrated and to make their offerings, and they finally took their places to perform their priestly duties. Unfortunately, it was not only a few priests who were not consecrated in time for the Passover feast. There was a flood of people from all over who were unclean. A generation had passed without anyone teaching these people the temple's ceremonial laws. No doubt there were people in Judah who had been eating unclean foods or had been near a dead body and so forth. I would not be at all surprised if people coming from the northern tribes had not even been circumcised. There were rituals to fix all of this, of course, but they were expensive, not only in offering livestock, but in taking the time and manpower to perform the ceremonies. As it was, there weren't even enough people to administer the Passover itself, much less to perform every minor cleansing ritual. Hezekiah recognized that these people were doing their best to serve God with a pure heart. He could not rightly turn them away over some trifling ceremonial matters, particularly when they were doing their best to fulfill the obligations and the resources just weren't in place to fulfill them. And so Hezekiah prayed to Jehovah that he would pardon these people for their uncleanness and welcome them for seeking him with a pure heart. We don't get any indication of exactly how God responded, but the passage does say that he heard Hezekiah's prayer and healed the people. Who knows? Maybe his acceptance of the unclean was demonstrated in a literal healing of a leper or some such. And so Hezekiah encouraged these people to come to the feast, and he encouraged the Levites to serve them. And so the people kept the feast with much singing and gladness, and in fact, everyone was having such a good time that at the end of the week, when the feast was over, they decided to just keep the festivities going for another week. So they had 2 weeks of feasting and sacrificing and worshiping. I suppose that they could have been strict about ending the services at the end of the week, but remember, they were bending the ceremonial rules to accommodate the people and their enthusiasm for Jehovah. To keep the feast rolling, Hezekiah and the ruling class of Jerusalem donated 2,000 bulls and 17,000 sheep, worth probably another $8 million. That's a lot of meat to sacrifice and feast upon. The priests and Levites must have stayed very busy. And so there was great joy in Judah. All the people, be they from Judah or the northern tribes, be they priests or kings or common people, all took great pleasure in the festival. The passage notes that the Passover had not been held in this way since the times of Solomon. That does not necessarily mean that the Passover had not been held at all, but that the Passover had not been held in this way, with attendance from the northern tribes. And so the priests and Levites blessed the people. God heard their prayers, and the feast ended. Moving on to chapter 31, we find that after the Passover, the religious reforms continued and spread. This was not some one-week revival that resulted in no change thereafter. This was the beginning of a larger movement. The people who had been present at the Passover went to their homes all over the country, and wherever they went, they tore down the altars that were there. This activity went on all throughout not just Judah and Benjamin, but Ephraim and Manasseh as well. Not enough activity in the northern tribes to rescue them from captivity, I suppose. These Passover-observing Israelites, I assume, were in a minority. Probably the majority of their hometowns viewed them as vandals and religious hate criminals. My guess is that when the exile happened, this minority were the ones who were left behind or returned to Judah. Verse 2 describes for us how Hezekiah appointed priests and Levites to their respective services at the temple, making offerings, performing music for worship, etc. I find that to be interesting. The king was the executive of the government, and I squirm at the idea of government intervention into the function of the religious order. But we can't forget that this was a thoroughly religious government. The king was appointed by the priests to his executive role. Apparently, in that capacity, he had their approval to have some administrative duty over the activities of the temple. He did not have the power to appoint priests. They were the descendants of Aaron. But apparently, in practical affairs, like who was working at what gate, apparently he was given some say. The king was also heavily bankrolling the operation from his own personal wealth. He himself provided the animals for the morning, evening, Sabbath, and new moon sacrifices. That said, the king did not personally pay all of the bills. The king also commanded the people to bring a tithe. Now, we don't get any indication that the king threw anyone in prison or laid any other penalty on them for failing to pay, but he did order them to do it. And when the word got out, the rest of the people brought their tithes. One gets the impression that they were excited about giving because they were excited about the work that the temple was doing. And so the people gave. They brought in the first fruits of their harvests and their tithes of both livestock and the fruits of their land. In fact, they brought so much stuff that it all stacked up in heaps. They had so much stuff coming in that for months they had growing piles of offerings getting larger and larger outside the temple. That's a good problem to have, I suppose, and Hezekiah blessed the people for their generosity. He also inquired about what might be done to fix the storage problem. There was an easy enough solution, since there had been chambers within the temple intended to hold these stores of goods. Hezekiah therefore directed the priests and Levites to restore these rooms so that they could be used for their purpose, and they did that. In verses 12 through 15, we get a listing of the names of the men who were involved in keeping all of the stuff. A few of these we mentioned above as potentially being the same as some of the men who were involved in the initial consecrations and restorations in chapter 29. I don't find any compelling indication that any of these names are mentioned anywhere else in Scripture. I do note, though, that the names Conaniah, Jehiel, Jozabad, and Shemaiah are all mentioned in 2 Chronicles 35:8 through 9 as the names of Levites who helped perform the Passover in Josiah's generation. Perhaps these are the same men. If they were young in Hezekiah's reign, they could reasonably have survived to continue serving under Josiah, but that story occurs about 85 years later, so this seems unlikely. More likely, these were just other Levites with common names. The men listed were appointed to distribute the tithe to everyone who was supposed to receive it, and they did the job well. They ensured that the priests and Levites, young and old, along with their dependents, both in the city and out of the countryside, got their portions. The passage ends by saying that in all of his administration, and apparently in everything else, Hezekiah did good. He did what was right. He conformed himself to the truth, and thus he worked with all his heart, and in all he did, he prospered. In application, I first note that being mocked for one's faith is not at all enjoyable. We read here in chapter 30 that Hezekiah sent a delegation to all the tribes of the northern kingdom to invite them to the Passover. The invitation was not at all well received. The messengers were heavily mocked. It is unfortunate that they were mocked. We would think that mocking people is rarely the best course of action. Even when people are wrong, we would prefer gentle correction to mocking. Mocking only embarrasses people, which makes them hate the mocker. That rarely does anything to move a person in the right direction. But if ever mockery is the right course of action, we would hope that it would be done by a mocker who is in the right and toward a mockee who is in the wrong. Of course, that isn't what we get here. Hezekiah's messengers were in the right, bringing people to truth and offering them a chance for reconciliation with God, that they might have a better life outcome. Their audience, the idolaters of the northern kingdom, was in the wrong, and so they mocked. No doubt, the mockers had a majority of the crowd. Certainly the messengers, a small handful of foreigners, were in the extreme minority. We all have a natural desire to fit in with the majority. This is a human nature. It is part of our survival instinct. Humans are social creatures. It is very difficult for us to survive and thrive on our own. When we are young, we need parents to care for us. We need friends to find a mate. We need co-workers to get the job done. We need a market to buy our products and our services. We need vendors to sell us the things that we need. If the crowd is against us, they may just beat us up. If the crowd is on our side, they may just rescue us from an assailant. And whomever has the most allies is more than likely going to win the war. For a human, cooperating with the majority tends towards surviving and thriving, while being in the minority means struggling and dying. And the smaller the minority, the greater the struggle. So we all want other people to like us. And not only that, but we want to be the most liked in the crowd. Standing up directly in the face of the crowd and saying something that the crowd finds to be foolish, making oneself look foolish in front of everyone, becoming hated by everyone, is contrary to every fiber of our beings. I suspect, for those reasons, that Hezekiah's messengers had a very emotionally trying time as they spread Hezekiah's invitation through the unwelcoming crowds of the northern kingdom. I am sure there were many days in which they wanted to just give up on the job and go home. In the end, maybe they did give up. The passage doesn't say explicitly that they ever made it all the way to Dan. Who knows? Maybe that's why the Danites aren't mentioned in Revelation's list of tribes in the end of times. But whether they did eventually give up or not, these messengers demonstrated some serious determination in spreading the word. At the very least, they spread their unpopular message city by city all the way through Asher's territory. And despite all the mockery, their work bore fruit. There were many representatives of the northern tribes who did attend the Passover. In whatever cities they passed through, there was some small minority of people who were willing to come, and that small minority added up to a lot of people. And those people mattered. They mattered to the Passover community, and they mattered to God. I think that these brave messengers set a good example for us today. In living the Christian life, we have a duty to proclaim the truth. We have a duty to call people to righteousness. We note that there is some practical limit to that duty. Jesus did tell us in Matthew chapter 7, verse 6, "Do not give dogs what is holy, and do not throw your pearls before pigs, lest they trample them underfoot and turn to attack you." There's no benefit to anyone in giving truth to people who just refuse to have it. Those people will only cause problems for the ones bringing the truth. But we must hold the duty to proclaim the truth and the caution not to needlessly endanger ourselves in balance, because among those swine there are a precious few whom we need to find and who need to hear the truth that we have. It is for this reason that we must always be ready to give an account to those who seek it, and we must never shy away from delivering the truth where it is necessary. We cannot fear the crowd. We cannot join hands with the many to do evil. We must stand for truth and righteousness no matter what the crowds say. In doing so, we may rescue a few from the fire. In our second application, we find in Hezekiah's reforms a significant willingness to bend the ceremonial rules to accommodate worship from a pure heart. We see several instances in which Hezekiah bent the ceremonial rules. The Levites had to help make the sacrifices because not enough priests had been consecrated. The Passover had to be moved back by a month since there was not enough time to handle the logistics for the feast. The unconsecrated and perhaps the uncircumcised were allowed to eat the Passover meal despite their ritual imperfection. In all these cases, there is a moral principle at play. It is a principle expressed in Hosea 6:6. "For I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings." The ceremonies of the temple were always intended as an outward expression of an inward reality. The rituals represent penitence. They represent the willingness of the worshiper to turn from his sin and to subject himself to God, to put away a life of sin and to live a life of righteousness. The sacrifices represent a sorrow for the sin of harming our fellow man and a desire to return to love and right fellowship. Without the internal matter of the human heart set in order, the external ceremony is meaningless and pointless. Imperfect rituals with the right heart are more important than perfect rituals with the wrong heart. Let's be perfectly clear here. The perfect performance of rituals without a right heart is a stench in the nostrils of God. See, for example, Isaiah 1:11 through 17, which incidentally was written in the same time frame. It says, "What to me is the multitude of your sacrifices, says the Lord? I have had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of well-fed beasts. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or of lambs or of goats. When you come to appear before me, who has required of you this trampling of my courts? Bring no more vain offerings. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath and the calling of convocations. I cannot endure iniquity in solemn assembly. Your new moons and your appointed feasts my soul hates. They have become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing them. When you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you will make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Wash yourselves. Make yourselves clean. Remove the evil of your deeds from before my eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Seek justice. Correct oppression. Bring justice to the fatherless. Plead the widow's cause." At the moment, there are many churches that are interested only in putting on a good show. "Don't disrupt the services," one might say. But meanwhile, the ones conducting those services are breathing lies and living on the side of oppression. The services are no good if the people will not do that which is good and just. If they will not repent, if they will not change their hearts, then all the praise and worship and prayers and performance of baptisms and communions will not earn them any favor with God. Now, I should be clear here. I'm not saying that there is no value at all in ceremony. If there weren't, then it would not be prescribed. We shouldn't tear down ceremony for no good reason, but we must keep ceremony in its proper place. Rituals should never get in the way of the work of the Holy Spirit. We should not ever put ceremony ahead of the human heart. And we should also be clear that we are talking about ceremony and ritual here, not moral law. These days, many churches have not only abandoned Old Testament rituals, but also Old Testament morals. They might claim that they are doing this in the interest of love over law, but they are wrong about that. As we have discussed before, we love our neighbors by respecting their rights and performing for them our duties. We can't claim to love our neighbor while we are stealing, killing, and destroying. So in elevating the human element over the ritual, we need to be sure that we are keeping our priorities straight. The ceremonial law, the priesthood, sacrifices, temple worship, tithes, cleanliness rituals, holidays, these things are all abrogated in the New Testament, as we have discussed at length elsewhere. Such things are only outward appearances and are of little value in the sight of God, and that, of course, is why they are abrogated. Ceremony still matters, but it should be the least of our concerns. Hezekiah had his priorities straight. He led his people in righteousness, and he put their spiritual needs over ceremonies. We should do likewise. And yet again, we see here that a good government is a God-honoring government. Hezekiah was devoutly religious. He was implementing God's laws, and he was unapologetically inviting the people to join him in serving God. Clearly, the passage portrays that in a positive light. We also note that in having a religious government, Hezekiah did not compel the people to cooperate in religious ceremonies, but led by example, giving from his own funds to support the temple. In this, he demonstrated great generosity. I must admit, I am a bit squeamish about Hezekiah's religious involvement. I very much want a government that is church-influenced, but I do not at all want a church that is government-influenced. But then maybe I need to be able to bend a little on that. Hezekiah the king was appointing priests and Levites to their duties. He was playing a managerial role. This role echoes that which both David and Solomon had played in the life of the temple, as mentioned in 2 Chronicles 8:14 through 15. We've seen just how dangerous it can be for a government to have power over the religious establishment. Look no farther than Hezekiah's father, who had effectively destroyed and shut the temple. When the government has power over religion, there's a serious danger to religion. But then, I have heard it said that there is nothing worse than a bad king and nothing better than a good king. After all, Jesus Christ is the good king. So maybe a king is not always a danger to the religious establishment. Hezekiah was not like the secular governmental leaders that we have experienced in the modern day. While he was playing a managerial role in the church, he was a devout believer, and he, like any other sincere believer, was part of the body with a purpose to serve. I think also that Hezekiah should not represent to us a role to be filled by any human leader today. Hezekiah was, at that time, a Messiah, that is, the anointed king of the people of God. In this capacity, he prefigured his descendant, Jesus Christ. Today, no one can fill the role that Hezekiah filled but Jesus himself. Jesus is the king of God's people. He is the head of the church, as we read in Ephesians 5:23, and the government shall be upon his shoulders, as we read in Isaiah 9:6. And so I submit to you that the church should submit to Christ, and that the government should submit to the right teachings of the church. The Bible does not teach religious neutrality, but rather, as we see here, the Bible teaches a religiously centered government. To conclude then, Hezekiah became king of the southern kingdom of Judah shortly before the northern kingdom of Israel went into exile. He was the son of Ahaz, who had been a bad king and an idolater. Hezekiah chose to do things differently. He directed the priests to purify the temple and to purify themselves and the people. And for the first time since the split, Hezekiah held a great Passover, sending messengers to spread the word to the northern tribes. Those messengers were particularly sturdy men who traveled far to deliver their message, despite receiving a great deal of mockery. But their determination is an example to us, and their work bore fruit. Jerusalem had the biggest and greatest Passover in centuries. The Passover was so big, in fact, that Levites had to be appointed to help with the priestly duties, and room had to be made for those who had not yet been consecrated. Ceremonial rules had to take a back seat to welcoming the whole family of God. We are reminded that the ceremony is a picture of the heart. God has never been so interested in ceremony as he has been in righteousness. And Hezekiah also demonstrates good leadership. He was not a secular king. He was instead devoted to Jehovah alone. He did not force people to worship Jehovah, but he did invite them to do so, and he led by example, giving of his own wealth to support the temple. Hezekiah is a reminder to us that a good government must be a God-honoring one.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.